contemporary artists are up to with a raft of new releases. That's Open Sky, Sundays from 2 until 4 p.m. with your host, Willard Jenkins, on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM. Don't sleep.
Another man done gone. Another man done gone from the county farm. Another man done gone.
Huh? I don't know. What? I'm just going across the street.
Shut your mouth.
Oh, no. What I do?
Turn around. Put your hands behind your back. Let's go.
The jury of your peers having found you guilty. 10 years.
What? Come on!
I was in jail too, man. It's cold-blooded in the jail. You go down there looking for justice. That's what you find. Just us.
Welcome to another edition of Crossroads Today. Now here's your host, Roach Brown.
Good morning and welcome to Crossroads. We come to you every Tuesday at the exact same time at 10 o'clock. And we've been doing this for 15 years. That is unbelievable. We come in every week for 15 years to do Crossroads. And ladies and gentlemen, it has been a pleasure and an honor. And I just want to say thanks to George Archie Childs, the gentleman who started Crossroads 15 years ago when he passed away. We took over where Archie left off. He used to be a member of the Inner Voices. So to our good friend, George Archie Childs, who's no longer with us, thank you for starting and creating Crossroads. And all we're doing is continuing what you started, Archie. We always open up with what we call the grapevine. But before we get to the grapevine, this is WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice. PFW is heard around the world, and particularly and especially to those men and women confined in institutions and jails and prisons across America who allow or permit our show to come in for these men to get this information that they can use when upon their release. So we'll start with what we call the grapevine, information that you can use, the grapevine. Through 1976, the Estelle versus Gamble decision by the U.S. Supreme Court established that incarcerated people are the only population in the country who have a constitutional right to health care. Do you hear that, Doc? The only people in the country who have a constitutional right to health care are those people incarcerated. So this would be a part of our discussion a little later in these meetings. Federal prisons are over capacity, yet efforts to ease overcrowding are ending. The Bureau of Prison System is in trouble and needs serious upgrades on several fronts. The Bureau of Prisons face a host of major challenges. Federal prisons are chronically short-staffed, creating dangerous conditions for both the people working there and for those who are incarcerated. The aging buildings are in need of major repairs and maintenance. The Bureau estimates its already overcrowded prison population will expand to 10% overcapacity in 2024. Despite the grim conditions, two programs which allow people to live in their communities while serving their sentence if they are not likely to commit new crimes have ended or at the risk of ending. Former BOP staffers and advocates for prisoner rights say that could increase the prison population at a time when resources are already strained. The Elderly Offender Program allowed people 60 years and older who have served most of their sentences and were incarcerated for offense categorized as nonviolent or non-sexual to be released to home confinement. It was a pilot program expanded by the First Step Act, which took effect in 2018. The program expired in September. Older people are far less likely to commit new crimes, according to government research. Incarcerating older adults is also expensive, as they require more medical care, which is especially costly behind bars because prisons have to supply transportation to and security at hospitals. Research suggests that it costs twice as much to keep an older person in prison than a younger one. The second program is part of the CARES Act passed in 2020, which addressed issues related to COVID-19. It allowed people to finish their prison sentences at home to ease overcrowding at the height of the pandemic. But legislation sponsored by Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee could force participants to return to prison. Now that the COVID-19 emergency is over, the policy is no longer feasible. Both liberal and conservative organizations have pushed back against these efforts to send people back to prison, citing data that shows CARES program poses little public risk. Excellence behind these cinder block walls. First woman to represent D.C. jail as the ANC sworn in commissioner. There's a young lady over the D.C. jail. There's nearly 1,700 residents at the D.C. jail and only 100 women, making this election win especially significant. The D.C. jail, or CTF, is a part of the Department of Corrections, and fortunately, D.C. has been in the forefront or the vanguard of appointing or electing ANCs. ANCs are advisory neighborhood commissioners whose job it is to bring the government closer to the people, and referred to as a unique experience. And D.C. is the only city that we know of in the country that allow an incarcerated person to run for elected office. So she represents the men and women at D.C. jail and CTF. And this is quite an accomplishment to be in prison and to be elected as an elected official while serving time and representing those men and women who are confined with you. So to our young lady, Shamika Hayes is the third person ever elected to this position, ANC, Advisory Neighborhood Commission, while incarcerated. Keep on keeping on, young lady. We will have you on the show very, very soon. There's a bill pending before the city council, or the council just passed some legislation, a massive crime bill submitted by City Councilman Brooke Pinto. And I haven't read the 90-page document, but one thing that stood out and knocked me down and knocked my hat off and made me jump up in my seat. The bill would allow D.C. police officers to review body cam videos before filing their report. And that's some jiggy boogie. Your arrest report is the main document you use for the prosecutor and for all the evidence of how this crime originated. And there's 19 states that refuse to call police officers to testify in criminal cases because they've been known to lie and shade the truth. We've seen cases of this happening. Why are you going to let the police view the body cam before they write up their report? Do you allow the defendants the same access to look at the body cam before we are charged or before we stay and go to court? This is one of these things, again, this jiggy-boogie, where you're allowing the police more freedom and right. And the 14th Amendment states equal protection under the law. If the police have the right to view the video of body cams, shouldn't the defendant have the same right? That's something we'll be fighting and be discussing on this show. Lastly, Oregon and Washington leadership take steps to tackle spike in overdose deaths. A surge in fentanyl deaths in the Pacific Northwest, including among children, has prompted leaders in Oregon and Washington to name overdose deaths a top issue and take aggressive steps to confront the problem. One way Oregon and Washington want to reduce fatalities is by more widely distributing the opioid overdose reversal medication, such as naloxone. I can't pronounce that word. Oregon State's Health Department said plans to offer 3 opioid overdose reversal kits to middle and high schools, and a newly filed bill with Oregon State Health Department said it plans to offer 3 opioid overdose reversal kits to middle and high school children. And that's been what we call the grapevine, information that you can use. Now we're going to get to our guest, and our topic is rebuilding the village. Our guest is Dr. Edwin Chapman, has practiced in Washington, D.C. for over 40 years, specializing in internal medicine and addiction medicine. Over the past 20 years, he has investigated the complex mix of addiction, undertreated mental illnesses, and infectious diseases, criminal behavior, and chronic diseases. Dr. Chapman received his B.A. in 69 and M.D. in 73 from Howard University. He is board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine, the American Society of Addiction Prevention. I can go on and on and on. All I can say is that this guy is a doctor, a medical doctor. And would you believe for the past 5 months, I've been meeting with him 2-3 times a week. Every time I go to a meeting, there's Dr. Chapman. He's at this meeting on Saturdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays. He's one of the few people that I know of who spends his time not just talking, but he's rebuilding the community. So it's a pleasure and honor. We had you on last a couple of weeks ago, Doc. We played a part of what you had to say. But the crisis with opiate and fentanyl in Washington, D.C. and across this country is off the chart. More people are dying from fentanyl overdoses than there are from gun violence. And this man is on the front line in the community every time you see him doing something. So, Dr. Chapman, this is an emergency. We brought you back in again, because we're talking about this crisis with fentanyl and how our men, and particularly black folk, are the biggest recipient of this opiate fentanyl overdose. Good morning, Dr. Chapman.
Good morning, Mr. Brown. Glad to see you after having breakfast with you on Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon.
Sunday afternoon, and good morning, Nikisha Taifa.
Good morning, Roach Brown and Dr. Chapman and guests.
Yeah, and thank you.
It's very critical.
Yeah, we had brunch Sunday, Dr. Chapman. And every time I turn around, me and this guy get together to have us a breakfast or lunch and meet. Dr. Chapman always come up with something that's designed to benefit, to improve our community and get our people off of fentanyl and that kind of stuff. So I want to say thank you. This fentanyl overdose crisis has reached more, has surpassed the epidemic proportions in this city. What's your take on this opioid fentanyl overdoses in Washington, D.C., Doc?
So thanks again, folks. The opioid epidemic has spread across the country. And as you know, in around 2000 or thereabouts, there was a increase in overdoses primarily noted in rural and suburban areas. Although in urban areas like Washington, D.C., we've had a smoldering opioid problem since the Vietnam era, primarily heroin. But this whole opioid problem has now coalesced into a fentanyl problem in about 2014 or 2015. So the suburban and rural opioid epidemic switched to street drugs. And the same thing happened in our community, although in our community, because it was heroin to begin with, for the most part, our patients were disproportionately going from heroin to fentanyl. So we saw a major increase in the District of Columbia from 20% fentanyl in 2015 to 98% fentanyl in 2022. The District of Columbia has the second highest per capita opioid overdose rate in the country. We're at about 70 per 100,000. But when you look at the African American community, because we're only 46% of the population, it's virtually double that. It's about 130 to 140 per 100,000.
Wow. So what, I just read something that said fentanyl is killing older black D.C. residents. And I come through your neighborhood every day. I've been enrolled. I know Joe Henry, and I see folks who've been involved in drug recovery for the past 20, 30 years. And even these guys are saying, man, this is something that's beyond anything we've ever seen in this city, that folk are dying and dropping, in particular, and especially black males or black folk are the highest category of folks dying from overdose of fentanyl. And not only that, when I saw the pictures, Doc, that the gentleman showed us a few weeks ago of how that that drug tranquilizer that's being mixed with opioid and the fentanyl is really eating people's bodies and skin up from the inside. And it just turned my stomach. And I've seen some terrible sights in my life. But to see what the impact and the damage that these drugs is doing on people's bodies is unbelievable.
Yes, so several things are happening at the same time or in parallel. One, COVID exacerbated or really brought out the health disparities in our country based on economics. And post-COVID, we've seen a significant increase in homelessness. So as we've noted a number of times, I've been on Benning Road, Northeast Washington for 43 years. And for the first time, we have homeless tents in the median strip with streetcars going past in both directions. We have a homeless tent by the dumpster behind my medical building. That's never happened before. So homelessness has increased. The second thing that you mentioned was these synthetic drugs that are increasing. You mentioned trank or xylazine, which is an animal tranquilizer, which is now being added to fentanyl. We know that fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine. But now when you add these other synthetic drugs like trank or even mixtures with cocaine or amphetamines, all of these drugs are mixed together, and that's exacerbated the overdose death rate.
You know, something else is connected to this. The overdose death rate inside of correctional facilities is on the increase. And then the question that runs, how did these guys and women get this drug inside of federal and state prisons or correctional facilities? And they're overdosing, and the overdose rate is increasing for men and women inside of prisons. What's your take on that, Doc?
So there's been resistance, particularly in the criminal justice system, to use what we call medications for opioid use disorder. And those medications, they're generally three medications that are FDA approved. Methadone, which has been around 60 or 70 years. Buprenorphine, or the street, more common name is Suboxone. And naltrexone, which is an injectable medication. Our prison system has resisted this for many years, stating that they don't have drugs in prison. So if you ask the warden or whoever runs the jails, they'll say, we don't have drugs in prison, but we know that that's not true. One of the good things that we can point out in the District of Columbia, a pilot demonstration project was started about a year ago inside the D.C. Detention Center, now allowing these medications to be used. So people don't have to come into jail who are addicted to opiates and go cold turkey. They can be placed on either methadone or buprenorphine while incarcerated. Now, some prisons prefer naltrexone, but that's a different story. I think the two drugs that we know actually reduce overdose deaths are methadone and buprenorphine. And the theory behind that is if you're in for even a short period of time and you started on medication while incarcerated, the chance of you overdosing and dying is reduced by 50 or 60% once you're discharged. We know
why is that? Why is that?
Because when people are incarcerated and they're taken off of opioids, their tolerance goes down. So that when they're discharged, if they go back into the community,
Their
tolerance is down and they use the same type of drugs that they were using when they went in, they're more likely to overdose. And there are any of a number of studies that show that the overdose rate in the first 2 weeks post-discharge from prison off of medication is about 12 times higher than the normal population.
You know, it just dawned on me. I used to be addicted to heroin back in the 60s, Doc. And we used to go to the hospital and get D.C. General to get Dolophine, which was a precursor before the one you're using right now. And we went in just to get your habit reduced So you can feel the effects of the drugs. When you take it for a certain period of time, your level of tolerance goes up. So if you want your tolerance to come down, you have to go in and reduce or try to kick your habit so that you can enjoy the effects of it. So that's what I'm talking about or getting to. How is this? How bad is this problem, doctor? I mean, you've been doing this for 40 years, and I see you every week. How bad is it? Because I hear every day I'm hearing somebody's so-and-so overdose or somebody's kid, and you can just touch fentanyl and you can die. How bad is this, and how is it ripping our community apart?
So this is a national crisis. It primarily started in the northeast section of the country, but it's spreading rapidly across the rest of the country. My patients obviously are older patients. The average age of my patients is 60, but you have to understand that these drugs that we're talking about now are synthetics, and many of the precursor ingredients come from China, and they've been assembled in Mexico and then imported into this country. But now they reportedly have super labs in Canada. So a lot of these drugs, because they're so potent and can be packaged in very small containers, are easy can easily be mailed into the country. So this whole idea that illegal immigrants are bringing the drugs across the border is a misnomer. These drugs are now being smuggled through the mail. They're coming in through normal channels, through ports, etc. They're very powerful drugs, and getting even more powerful. There are other drugs, synthetic drugs, like the nitazenes, that are even more powerful than fentanyl and the fentanyl analog. So you have chemists who are putting these drugs together to make money, and they're heartless, and they'll continue to do this as long as we don't provide the appropriate treatment on the other side. So treatment is the key. We have to get our patients, our citizens, on medication.
You know, I got an email from you a couple of weeks ago, and you sent the email to the mayor, Muriel Bowles of Washington, D.C., explaining the problem with the fentanyl and overdoses, but also that you had a few suggestions on what can be done to attack this problem. You want to share that with us, the letter that you mentioned you wrote to the mayor of Washington, D.C., explaining and highlighting the severity of this problem of fentanyl overdose deaths in Washington, D.C.
So Roach, we can't separate what we call the social determinants of health from all aspects of health care, whether it's high blood pressure or diabetes. And the same applies for addiction treatment and mental health. If you're homeless, the cost and the ability for us as medical providers to provide appropriate care is virtually, those costs skyrocket. So housing is critical. During COVID, if you'll notice, hotels were open in order to get the homeless off the street. But now, since COVID is gone, many of those facilities have been shut down. And that's one of the reasons why we have this rapid increase in homelessness and encampments around the city and around the country. So housing is critical. I think that we can reduce the cost of treatment, regardless of whether it's for opioid use disorder or mental health or diabetes, if we first house individuals. Then we know where they are.
You say housing. What role does housing play in this opioid epidemic? You mentioned twice that we need housing. Why?
If you look at our overdose statistics, for example, in 2022, we had 461 deaths. Of those 461 deaths, 116, virtually 30%, were people either who were classified as undomiciled or unknown. If your housing is unknown, I consider that homeless. So if you add that together, but if you look back 10 or 15 years ago, only 2% of the overdose deaths were classified as homeless. So there's a direct correlation between housing and overdose. And you have to understand stress goes up under those circumstances. And people often will turn for relief to alcohol and drugs.
Nikisha, you want to jump in, Nikisha?
So I just want to say I always appreciate everything that Dr. Chapman is doing, and particularly when he talks about the social determinants of health. And also, I'm so much, very much dealing with the criminal punishment system aspect of it, and the critical importance of this being looked at as a public health issue as opposed to a criminal punishment issue, which again disproportionately impacts our people and the like. And I guess the question that I have is, people use fentanyl to ease the pain. It takes away the pain. So the issue of dealing with what is causing this pain that people feel the need to use substances such as fentanyl to relieve that pain, despite the fact of the dangers that it itself causes.
So we're talking about emotional pain, so-called toxic stress, oppression. That is just as painful as, we don't think about that as being pain, but it's just as painful as physical pain. And so people will use different types of drugs to relieve that emotional stress or that emotional pain. The most common drug is probably alcohol.
You're right. Well,
You know that we usually get the question all the time: why do men and women inside of prison get high or use drugs? Why do people in the street use drugs and get high for an escape? And you and is amplified inside of institution because you have no outlets, no diversions, and because you're in so much pain constantly, daily, 7 days a week, you look for an escape or an out. And these men are turning to drugs inside of institutions. And I read something the other day that I didn't know that they was now understand why. They got, most prisons got policies where they don't let you get your mail. If you send a letter to somebody in prison, they photograph it or photocopy it and give you a copy of the letter. And the reason being that folks will put fentanyl on the envelope or somewhere on the paper. And when the guys get it, they would scrape it off and get high. So that's just one way they was using to get fentanyl inside. There's other ways they're using it. But folks look for escape when you're hurting with intense pain, prolonged daily pain. And this fentanyl offers that kind of relief. The question is, what can we do, Doc? We having problems out here in the street. It seems like we can have a better chance of reducing or stopping opioid inside of institutions since it's a closed, controlled environment. But that doesn't seem to be the case. What can folks who are listening to you this morning, Doc, do? Because I know a couple of women would call and say that their husband had been pressing them to send them something. You know what I mean? And they didn't want to do it. And they didn't want to get involved in it because they got arrested. They get locked up and go to jail also. And the guy is not even being cognizant of the position he's placing the young lady in. And she may have 2-3 kids. And I've had phone calls from 2-3 ladies saying they don't want to go back to see the boyfriend or husband because they want them to bring something in and they don't want to do that. And because of this fentanyl, they are extra scared. They don't want to play a part. And if they give them something and they die, they are guilty of participating in that person's death.
So again, as I mentioned earlier, the District of Columbia instituted a pilot project last year, starting medication for assisted treatment or opioid treatment in the jail, in the D.C. detention center. So they now have methadone and buprenorphine. If you're already on methadone or buprenorphine in the jail, they when you come in, they keep you on it. In the past, they would take you off the medication. Those are the only medications in the history of mankind that that they would actually take you off of. They would never take you off of insulin or never take you off of blood pressure medicine when you entered the jail. But this medication across our criminal justice system is the one classification of drug that our prison system refused to use. Now we're moving in the opposite direction so that these medications will be provided for people who are in jail, just like any other medication. We're changing from this being a criminal justice problem to a medical problem. And that's a process.
Okay. You know, this is...
Roach, go ahead. Vic from Germany has been hanging on the line, wanting to...
Come on, I don't even see him on the screen. Come on in, Rick. Come on in,
Good
Rick.
Good morning, man. Good morning. Can you hear
Good
me?
Good morning, Rick. How you doing, man?
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Where are you in Germany?
I'm just 15 minutes outside of Munich in a small town called Gilking.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Is the doctor still there?
Yes, he's waiting to hear what you got to say.
I would like to ask the doctor if Volunteers of America Chesapeake is still in Washington, D.C., and if they're still getting people off the streets in terms of housing and psychiatric care.
Did you hear him, Doc?
I heard him. I'm not sure what organizations are working with the homeless. What I do know is that our homeless population has increased radically, and we don't have the facilities to accommodate.
Well, I was blessed by coming out of the shelter into Volunteers of America Chesapeake and then getting housing. But my current wife, she realized that I got would never meet the rules and regulations, the standards for government approval, and that so she invited me to Germany. But Volunteers of America Chesapeake was crucial in getting me off the streets and getting me housing when I was homeless there in D.C.
So let me just describe what I see every day. My office has been at 16th and Benning Road for 43 years. And again, we have brand new high rises going up in the middle of the block. There was a church in the middle of the block. We have two brand new high rises going up across the street that I can see. But at the same time, I can look out my window and see four homeless tents in the middle of the street. So one of the problems that we have is an economic problem. We have in the district the most rapid gentrification in the country, meaning that the cost of that housing that I just described is out of reach for many people. And a lot of the public housing, a quarter of the public housing is unusable. We have the worst public housing department, according to HUD, in the country. So when you combine those economic issues with the medical issues, with the trauma, the emotional trauma, you can see how these problems can quickly exacerbate.
Hey, let me ask you this, Rick, you still there?
I'm still here, man.
Hey, you left D.C. how long ago and went to Germany? And did you have a drug habit before you left?
No drugs, but I was getting seriously addicted to alcohol. Alcohol is legal both in America and in Germany, and many of us go down the tubes, down the toilet, legally with alcohol.
Okay. All right. And how long have you been in Germany now?
It's almost 11 years. It'll be 11 years this Christmas.
Are y'all having a fentanyl problem, a drug overdose problem over there in Munich?
Yes, sir.
Wow. So this, like you said, this is worldwide. This problem is worldwide.
So I'm just curious, Rick, from Germany, the problem that's there in Germany, is there a racial aspect to it, or is it affecting the population in general?
Well, there are some sisters here in Germany who make a loud noise about racism in Germany. But the truth is, the world is in a bad state. And in Germany, you have housing, you have food, you have education access. So, yes, there's racism in Germany, but you have to consider what you have also with that racism. And there are many blacks who have citizenship as well.
I see.
Okay. You're listening to Crossroads on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice. If you wish to call in and participate in the discussion, the phone number is 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. All right. Glad to hear from you, Rick. I mean, you were something else, man. I knew there was some racism. And in fact, there's very few places you can go that we don't encounter racism. It's just, a fact of life and the way it is, but we need to do something about that. Dr. Chapman, what can we do? People using drugs for escape to get away from the pain and the hurt. And when you go to the doctor, they try to find out what's the cause. Why did you start? What caused you to get affected or affected with this or whatever? What can be done to reduce the desire or the motivation to begin to even use fentanyl or opiates? What can be done? And what would you see that we can suggest that, hey, if you do this X, Y, Z, this will reduce the chance of you getting involved in that? Is there anything?
So there are multiple facets to this whole problem, Roach. We have to look at, in our older population, we talk about some of the economic stress or stressors. We really have to now look at what we call the pair of ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences and adverse community environments. Many of the people that we treat, when you talk to them and talk about the circumstances that they grew up under, you will find that trauma existed in their childhood. Mm-hmm. And we don't talk about that. But when you really delve into that and now look at the family structure, just look at what's going on around us now with the murders in our community, with children afraid to walk to school, with older people afraid to walk the streets. That we're talking about adverse community environments. We're talking about the homelessness that we see every day. All of those are stressors in the community. So unless we deal with the economic disparities, we're going to continue to have this problem. We're really talking about an increasing economic divide. There were two Princeton economists that talked about diseases of despair. Annie Case and her husband, I believe, got a Nobel Prize discussing that and really equating that to the decrease in American life expectancy. And we don't talk about that. The United States, as rich as it is, has one of the lowest life expectancies of industrialized countries. And part of that problem is the fact that we don't have national health insurance. We're one of the few, if not the only, industrialized country that does not have national health insurance. So all of this is coming to so that we have so many people who need treatment but can't get treatment because they don't have health insurance.
Well, what's going on with this? I know it always go back to economics and to monies. And the most, I think, is ageism. There's a lot of seniors, particularly black seniors, are overdosing. And these guys in their 50s and 60s, it's almost like they're committing a form of a suicide because they know what this drug would do, and yet they're taking it because they don't have a job, they ain't got a house, ain't got no place to stay, no visible means of income coming in. And me and my wife get into a discussion all the time. And we go to the 7-Eleven, and there'd be two, three guys in front of 7-Eleven opening the door. And when you come out, you know they want something. You know what I mean? And they're trying to do whatever they can. Then they take that money and go get high. So what is it? I know what it is, man. I use drugs myself. And you go back to the economy. These young kids who couldn't get high in the bathroom, in the schools during lunch break, and they're trying to experiment. And a lot of these kids don't have no idea what's going on. And they're risking their lives. And we did something back in the 70s with a group called the Inner Voices. We put on plays that were designed to reach these kids and let them know about the pitfalls and the disadvantages of getting high. And I'm working on the same thing with my wife and I. We're putting something together now, Doc, and you and I talk. But I asked you a question a little while ago, Doc. You wrote a powerful letter to the mayor of Washington, D.C. And in the letter, you had some strong language in there. You're saying that you know what can be done to fight this problem, this heroin epidemic, fentanyl epidemic in Washington, D.C. And you got the resources and contacts that you can bring to bear to really work on this. And the mayor passed a bill, the city council is considering releasing this massive crime bill. What can be done from your perspective in that letter that you sent to the mayor, that you know what can be done and you got people who can do it? And have you got a response from that letter from the mayor's office?
No, I haven't gotten a response. But let me just frame this in economics again. You've heard about the crisis in Chinatown around the basketball stadium and the fact that Ted Leonis has said that he wants to move the team in part because of the atmosphere there. That atmosphere is pervasive across the city. We have the same problem in my parking lot. So the mayor offered $500 million to help renovate the area around Chinatown. But we could take a quarter of that money.
Yes.
Let's say $200 million and actually give people jobs in the community that can actually get people off the street, put them in, it might be a hotel again, or housing, and give them the services that they need.
Yeah, wraparound services, yes.
Wraparound services. That will reduce medical costs, because if we leave people on the street, we know what's going to happen. I had a patient to get double pneumonia and die in the past month. I had a patient to get hit by a car and die. So we know what's out there. If we take people off the street and use the people in the community who are looking for jobs, who are looking to help, and we know who those people are because we meet with them every week.
There you go.
We can reduce the medical costs. We can reduce the criminal costs. Just think about this. Giant in Southeast was talking about closing because people were stealing Colgate toothpaste and Tide and Advil. Now, what does that tell you? Who steals toothpaste and they want their teeth to be clean? They steal the Tide because they want their clothes to be clean, and they're stealing Advil because they're in physical pain.
Yeah.
But if you give people what they need, just basic things, they won't do that. And the costs will go down. And the stores can stay open. This is simple. We have 5,000, I believe approximately 5,000 homeless people in this city. There's 700,000 residents in this city. You mean to tell me we don't have enough money to take care of 5,000 people and get put a roof over their head. I mean, we don't leave we don't leave dogs and animals on the street. We take them to the shelter, but we leave human beings on the street. This is unbelievable. This is inhumane. In the last couple of weeks, there's been a debate over SNAP.
Yes.
Increasing the food. So the city council had to threaten the mayor to sue in order to get $40 million to increase SNAP. I mean, we got a leadership problem. I'll be very frank with you. We have a leadership problem.
You know, and you're right, it's a leadership problem. And we talk about this at our meetings that we have on a regular basis. We meet every Wednesday, some Saturdays, Thursdays with Dr. Chapman and a host of other community organizations. And you're right. We need housing. Somebody go to the doctor and they're bleeding from the nose or whatever, and the doctor want to find out what were you exposed to, what caused this. So you go back and investigate what led up to this person bleeding from the nose. This process has not been applied to what we're talking about now. There's causations. What are the causes of these people getting involved? And a lot of it is economic desperation, homelessness, food deserts. We got kids, man, who that's carjacking at 12, 13, 14 years old. They're talking about punishing them, locking them up, taking them to trial as adults. But then I haven't heard nobody yet say, what's the cause behind this? What's leading these kids up to that? What's on their mind before they take somebody's car? What are they trying to do? What's the underlying motivating factor? And we're not addressing that. We're talking about locking them up and punishing them. Sure, we all got to be accountable for our actions. But D.C. has the largest population of men and women sentenced for long periods of time in prison and sent all over America. So you're talking about doing the same thing all over again to these youngsters. We haven't looked at what caused them to steal this car. Where was they at? Was it? Are they from a home? You said it's 5,000 homeless people, but they don't include the youth. Dr. Chapman, we run into some kids, whole gangs of kids who don't have no place to go, nowhere to stay. They're not included in none of these studies because they don't have a driver's license. They don't work nowhere, so they're not on the official government rolls. So they can't include them. But we got thousands or hundreds of young kids walking the street, and they walk the street all day long with no income, no jobs, no way of making no money. And the only way they can make money is take things. When you say about the giant and he came in and stole the Colgate and Advil, to me, that's acts of desperation. When you got somebody going to steal soap, toothpaste, toilet paper, these are desperate, broke individuals. They can't afford toothpaste. Why not? There's no job. They're talking about the unemployment rate is 5%. In our community, it's 65 to 70% or higher. So we need to, again, provide housing, wraparound services. And I'm pissed off, man, when he said $4 billion to Ukraine, $30 billion to Israel, and all we need is a few billion here. And we can solve a lot of problems we're having. But they can send it out of the country to other entities, and we don't get a dime here, and we need it here.
So yesterday, I attended a breakfast in Montgomery County, sponsored by Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity. That's my fraternity. And the governor of Maryland, Wes Moore, spoke.
Yes.
And the conversation was totally different. He talked about housing. He talked about education. He talked about food services. He talked about health care. So you're listening to a leader who understands that people are in pain and that you have to provide services. You're not hearing that conversation here in the district. What you're hearing is that these people are a problem and that we need to find ways of getting rid of them as opposed to accommodating their needs. And that's the difference. That's the difference in leadership. And until we get that type of leadership, we're going to continue to have this problem in our nation's capital. This is, to me, is criminal negligence.
But what can we do as lay people? We have the power as a people. What do we need to do to make people hear us, stand up, and demand something?
Well, you voted, you got what you voted for.
You got what you had voted for, yeah.
You laughed, but you got what you voted for.
Yes.
You voted for nothing and you got nothing.
You know, Doc, this is interesting because we got some things that we know what would take to reduce, or not solve the problem, but reduce it and make it manageable. But we can't get the resources. You can't get to the right people. Yesterday, we went to the Washington Wizards and Detroit Pistons basketball game at the Capital One Arena. And we were guests of Miss Virginia Ali. And during halftime, they had a special ceremony or program for Miss Ali for Ben's Chili Bowl. And they gave out, I'm holding this up now, they gave out thousands of these bobblehead dolls of Miss Virginia Ali holding a half smoke. And you seen little kids walking around and through it. And it was so heartwarming and inspiring. And Miss Ali and her family are supportive of what we're talking about. Her son, Kamal, has been through several of our meetings with trying to bring the business community to the table to see what we can do to generate the resources we need. We got a T-shirt, hoodies out called All Hands on Deck. And we need everybody. And nothing that's coming from have I heard from the mayor's office or from this new massive crime bill, which was sponsored by city council member Brooke Pinto, about returnees. You got people who got expertise in these particular fields who are not being utilized. Folk who know what it takes to get somebody off of this or how to relate to them and communicate with them. And we're not utilizing it. If this is a massive national problem, fentanyl overdoses, carjacking, the deaths, we need to call, have all hands on deck, and that's not been included. And your letter that you sent to the mayor, I keep going back to that letter, it was a powerful letter. And you explain in the letter what can be done, and you got resources and people who are willing to step up to the plate and do it, but you haven't gotten an answer. What do we do now, Doc?
You have to vote. But you have to get the right candidates that understand that there's another way. And that way is to employ people in the community. And we have to understand, this is biblical, if you really think about it, that 5,000 people, 5,000 homeless people can make it so uncomfortable for people to come downtown that businesses are closing, crime is going up, when all we have to do is do just the reverse. Take care of the least, last. Goodness.
There you go. There you go. There you go.
And I'm not, I don't have a church. You know, I'm not a preacher, but I know that much is in Matthew 25. And if you follow that, everything that you talked about, what have you done for the incarcerated? What have you done for the homeless? It's in the Bible.
Yeah.
Where are our pastors in terms of challenging our politicians on this issue? This is intolerable. They see the same thing that I see.
You know, Doc, we passed all these churches in Washington, D.C., and they don't have anything in the evening. The churches are closed. People land out on the sidewalk in front of the churches, beside the churches, and the big old edifices are locked and closed. There's nobody reaching out. And again, we say all hands on deck. When folks show
up, what do you think Martin Luther King would say if he was here?
He would raise hell. He said, "This ain't my dream. This is a nightmare." And this is a nightmare that we're going through. And King's dream had been turned into a nightmare. And he would be right on the front line, him, Reverend Ralph Abernathy, and that whole crew. The churches got to stand up. You hit it right on the head. Doctor, we got so many churches, over a few thousand churches in Washington, D.C. I don't know of any churches doing an overdose, fentanyl, fellowship, opening the doors to people coming in to make housing available, to feed for only a few. Again, all hands on deck. And I go back to your letter again to the mayor. We're saying everybody, but I think the churches, the synagogues, all of them, man, these are our people that they have the resources to open up the doors to help 5 or 10 people in their particular neighborhood. We can do this, but we don't
let me say one last thing. $110 million was spent over the past 5 years on the opioid epidemic. Guess how much money went to the went to the faith community out of that $110 million?
About half of it?
Less than 1%.
Around 1%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Around 1%. Yet the literature from SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, has literature out that shows, particularly in the African-American community, that the faith community is key to turning this around.
Yes, so, yes.
So at least a third of that money, at least a third of that money should have gone to the faith community, as far as I'm concerned. That would have been about $35 million.
So what do you suggest we do for now? At this joint now, what can we do? What do you suggest we do?
So we're going to have to demand that as this money comes in, there's another $30 million on the table right now from SAMHSA, that a large portion of that money go to our faith community. And not to folks just running to get some money now that it's on the table, but those that have already been doing the work, people that you've been talking about. And there are faith institutions in our community that have been doing this work, that have been distributing Narcan, that have been educating the community, but they have not been getting the resources.
You're right. And I want to clarify something. I'm not indicting all churches. There are some churches that are doing a powerful work, working in the community. We're talking about those that are not, and they could and should open up their doors and get involved. Because in the Bible it says, when you do this for the least of those, you do it for me. And we got a lot of folks who are least, lost, and less. And we got to make sure that they get the assistance they need. Because at one time, at one day, we might be in the same situation. That's one thing I've learned from going to prison. You can look down on somebody, but you never know when your turn is going to come. What happened to me can happen to you. It can happen to any one of us. And never think that we are...